Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You know how we've been talking about the European debt crisis and how that's the big problem over there? Yeah, it turns out there's a whole lot of other problems as well. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, the 2nd of May. Good to have you with us. And let's talk jobs as a way to get going today, all right? We're going to get the April unemployment report Friday morning. It's one of those A-list economic indicators that everybody pays pretty close attention to. The good people at ADP, who process payroll checks for many a private company out there, said this morning they're guessing Friday's jobs report from the Department of Labor is going to be fine. Some new jobs, but a little bit soft. One might want to use stronger language to describe the labor market over in Europe. We learned this morning the Eurozone lost almost 170,000 jobs last month. The unemployment rate over there is now 10.9%. Manufacturing's bad. There are big and controversial elections happening this weekend. Europe, it seems, is much more than just a debt crisis, as Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
Europe can be complicated, but Chris Williamson of the financial firm Market in London puts it simply. Really terrible numbers.
It's a double dip recession. It's a slump. All sorts of horrible words. It's a situation that we've not seen since the 1930s.
Spain just joined seven other Eurozone countries in recession. Its unemployment hit 24%. For young Spaniards, it's even worse. 5 in 10 are jobless.
It's changing the fabric of the whole society when there's that many people unemployed.
Economists are playing European Where's Waldo, hunting for signs of life. Governments that otherwise would spend their way out can't. They've pledged to balance budgets. Banks are holding on to money instead of lending to people. Even Germany saw its manufacturing slump to a near three-year low. Economist Karsten Breschke at ING Group in Brussels says no one's buying stuff, inside Europe or out.
The Chinese economy is slowing. U.S. economy is not really picking up. You would need to discover life on Mars if the German export success should continue.
This weekend, Greece and France hold elections. Many voters want to rein back the austerity programs, but that could unravel European unity. Before it gets to that, Paul Christopher at Wells Fargo figures the European Central Bank would swoop in and print money or bail out a free-falling country.
As long as the ECB can be the firewall, I think we will avoid a breakup of the euro.
He thinks Europe is bottoming out, but many, many others think it will get messier before it gets neater. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Europe's austerity economics is plunging the continent into recession, but the U.S. isn't far behind.
Commentator Robert Reich.
Here, first quarter growth slowed largely because of cuts in government spending. And early next year, additional spending cuts go into effect, along with a tax increase on the middle class. There's no chance the U.S. economy will be fully mended by then, so the next president, whoever it is likely to find himself in an austerity-induced recession. Austerity mavens in Europe and America are forgetting two big truths. First, the real goal isn't simply to reduce the deficit. It's to lower the deficit as a percentage of GDP. Spurring growth is paramount. So cutting government spending when consumers and the private sector are holding back removes the last remaining source of demand. It makes things worse. A large debt with faster growth is preferable to a smaller debt sitting atop no growth at all, and infinitely better than a smaller debt on top of a contracting economy. What I call austerical policymakers also overlook the social costs. Cutting spending when unemployment is high doesn't just worsen unemployment. It also removes the public services and safety nets people depend on when times are tough. This can lead to political upheaval. Last week, the Dutch prime minister was forced out. In the upcoming French election, Nicolas Sarkozy could well be unseated by a socialist. Across Europe, fringe parties on the left and the right are gaining ground. Such social and political instability is itself a drag on growth, generating more uncertainty about the future. Policymakers in the United States and Europe should abandon austerity economics. Instead, they need to set targets for growth and employment, and not cut government spending until those targets are met. Only then adopt austerity. It may be too late for Europe, but it's not too late for us. There's no reason we have to follow Europe off the austerity cliff.
Robert Reich teaches public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. His most recent book is called Beyond Outrage. On Wall Street today, not outrage really, but some disappointment perhaps in that ADP jobs report. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Looks like we're only going to have to wait just a little bit longer for the most awaited stock offering of this and many other years. There are burblings out there, neither confirmed nor denied by the company, that Facebook is going to hold its IPO on May 18th. The way these things generally work is that before the stock actually goes on sale, the company in question goes out and tries to convince big investors to buy in. It's called a roadshow. Facebook's is going to start Monday, we think, and we wanted to get some idea of what it might be like. So we called Phil Fernandez. At the moment, he's the CEO of a company called Marketo up in Silicon Valley. In earlier days, though, at other companies, he's been through his share of roadshows. Phil, it's good to have you with us.
Great to be here with you, Kai.
So the phrase roadshow, I mean, you can sort of see it in your mind. You know, companies go out on the road and they do a little show. But what exactly does it mean?
A roadshow is when a company is trying to sell, typically an initial public offering, its stock to the public market. So you're out trying to sell $100 or $200 million worth of stock to a bunch of big investors like Fidelity and T. Rowe Price and other big mutual funds.
Is it a couple of PowerPoints and then some dog and pony? I mean, what exactly happens in this presentation?
Well, it's meeting after meeting after meeting. And there's one-on-one meetings where you're actually doing typically a flipbook PowerPoint, not projecting, 10 or 15-minute meeting with a fund manager. And then you often do lunches or other big meetings where 50 or 100 people have come to a room to hear a company presentation standing in front of a big room.
Do you find yourself as a supplicant? I mean, it's a sales pitch, right?
It's absolutely a sales pitch. You're selling and it's a very high stakes sales pitch that all takes place typically in 10 or 15 minutes where you win or lose the deal right in that moment.
Do you know in that moment whether you've lost?
Oh, I think so. I think you either see somebody that engages and you connect, or if they're kind of wandering off and eyes are looking in another direction 5 minutes later, you know, they're not going to buy.
Yeah. But if it goes bad in one of these 10 to 15 minute meetings, you probably have like 9 more set up that day, right?
9 or 25 or something like that. I've done them from San Diego to Los Angeles to Denver to Minneapolis to New York all on the same day.
Yeah, it sounds grueling. I mean, it sounds like not a whole lot of fun.
You know, it's an incredible high because it's what you're doing is one of the, you know, most exciting things in a career. And at the same time, it is about as hellish as anything I've ever been through.
This might seem like kind of a rookie question to ask, but why do we need roadshows? I mean, why do you guys have to go do this? Isn't there a better way?
You'd sure like there to be a better way. In all things, there's this adage that says people buy from people. And I think this is exactly what this is. It's people looking people in the eye and choosing whether they're going to do business with them.
Yeah. What happens then after you do all these meetings and everything? You've either made the sale or you haven't, but you get back home wherever it is, and then what?
Well, the bankers are running what they call the books, which is the order book of who's going to buy and who's not. And they're figuring out, you know, if it's an IPO roadshow, exactly what the price is going to be. And, of course, what everybody wants is for the price to be above how you filed with the SEC. Mm-hmm. And so what happens is, you know, in the days of and right after the roadshow, you know, the deal comes together, it doesn't, and you have an IPO and go ring the bell at NASDAQ or New York Stock Exchange or whatever.
Yeah. Phil Fernandez, president and CEO at Marketo up in Silicon Valley. Thanks very much for your time, sir.
You bet. Enjoyed it, Kai.
We can cite economic statistics chapter and verse to try to give you some sense of how things are going out there. But sometimes it's just easier to use a single measure. In this case, the swipe of a credit or debit card. MasterCard announced quarterly results today. Profits were up 21% over a year ago. An encouraging sign on the face of it. Marketplace's Sally Herships has more.
Imagine if every single person on the planet, all 7 billion of us, swiped a MasterCard. Well, last quarter, the company processed almost 8 billion transactions, and each one generated a fee. Cha-ching. And because consumers are writing fewer checks, there are more transactions to process.
As an example, government benefit programs have shifted last year fairly dramatically from paper-based to card-based type products. So, you know, MasterCard's seeing the positive side of all of this.
Madeline Allseaser is an analyst with iTake Group. Charles Scuba teaches international business at Georgetown's McDonough School of Business. He says MasterCard is expanding its offerings.
companies like MasterCard are aggressively moving to create products in the area of mobile payments and also in the area of prepaid cards.
Whatever the use, MasterCard's global swipes rose by 29% last quarter. Visa's growth was smaller, but it had nearly twice the number of swipes, 13 billion. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Money, when you think about it, has no value in and of itself. A dollar bill really is just paper. But a dollar is worth a dollar because of what you can buy with it. And there are more and more things you can buy these days with cold, hard cash than ever before. Michael Sandel considers some of those things and the markets in which we buy them in his new book. It's called What Money Can't Buy. Michael Sandel, good to have you with us.
Good to be with you.
I wonder if, and far be it for me to challenge the author on a title, but shouldn't this be called What Money Shouldn't Buy?
Yes, you're right.
Okay, good. Thanks for coming in.
Well, sort of. You're sort of right. There's a connection between what money can't buy and what it shouldn't buy. But you're right. I'm mainly concerned with what money should not buy. The cases I look at are controversial cases of commodification, trying to motivate kids to do better in school by paying them to read more books. And so we might crowd out the desire to learn for the love of learning. And that's what economists often miss, the norms and attitudes that market values can displace. And that's what I'm worried about.
All right. Well, let me pick something a little less value judgment based, right? You spend the first chapter of this book on paying people to stand in line for you.
Right.
Which, on the face of it, kind of makes sense.
Not only for concerts and World Series tickets, things like that, but do you know that to listen to the Supreme Court arguments in a case, on
health care, just for instance, right? That
there you happened. Go. Yeah. They hire line-standing companies who hire people, often the homeless, to stand in line for 24, 48 hours overnight. Now, from a strictly economic point of view,
right,
it is efficient. But isn't there a value here beyond efficiency?
Well, explain that a little bit, because the corporate lawyer will say, my time is worth more than $125 an hour, so I can add to society's value that they get from me by working at my job while this person stands in line. And also that person gets $125.
Well, that's true. Actually, the company gets a good share of it.
Well,
but the homeless
yeah.
person may get $18 an hour for his or her time. So it's a voluntary exchange. But you could do it another way. You could cure the inefficiency in the market by having the Supreme Court could auction off seats. But we would consider that corrupting the meaning and purpose of representative government. But if it would be wrong for the government to set a price, isn't there something demeaning to put it up for sale through line-standing companies?
I wonder if, and I get that it takes a long time to write a book, but I wonder if you're a little bit late because in raising these questions, because if the financial crisis that we lived through 3.5, 4 years ago didn't shake our faith in markets, can anything possibly do it?
I think many people thought there would be a kind of moral questioning about markets in the wake of the financial crisis. Mm. It hasn't happened because we're very reluctant to bring controversial moral questions about what is the right way to value education or health or military service. These are the questions I think we need to debate.
Michael Sandel is a professor of government at Harvard University. His most recent book is called What Money Can't Buy: The Moral Limits of Markets. Thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
Coming up, consider this come Mother's Day. Those flowers, they ain't all they're cracked up to be.
And I do not want to rain on your mother's parade or anybody's mother's parade, but there is something going on here.
The Freakonomics behind the bouquet. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow down 10 points today. We'll call that statistically flat. Ended at 13,268. The NASDAQ up 9 points, 3/10%, closed at 3,059. The S&P 500 shed 3 points, a quarter of 1% finished at 1402. That discouraging ADP report we told you about helped push down financial stocks. Citigroup sagged more than 2.5%. Bank of America declined nearly 2%. We told you about MasterCard's strong earnings. While the stock dropped by almost 1% today, MasterCard said it has doubts about consumer confidence going forward. Visa gave back 0.7% today. No luck for Time Warner. Its stock rewound more than 1.5% today. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.93%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases its preliminary productivity and costs report for the first quarter. Chain stores are due to report sales figures for April. And party at the White House. President Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama host a Cinco de Mayo reception. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We're a couple of weeks away now from the biggest economic events of the television season, the upfronts, the big parties and previews of new shows that networks roll out to convince advertisers to buy commercial time. It's a big deal. $9 billion worth of ad time on the line. And, of course, when you're talking that kind of money, there is bound to be some competition. Competition is called new front as opposed to upfront. Get it? A lot of the same big brand advertisers are there. It's the shows that are different. These shows have been created by Yahoo and Google and Hulu to be watched online, with ads, of course. As the digital upfronts close today, Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports on new media and the advertising dollar.
Thousands of people from advertising agencies, television studios, Hollywood, and, of course, internet companies came together for the digital upfronts this year. The goal? Advertising the possibilities of online video to advertisers.
Welcome. Thank you for coming, everyone.
Mark Beeching is chief creative officer at online marketing company Digitas. He created this event 5 years ago.
Seeing that there was no venue, no market space for brands to seize all the opportunity now, so this was really as simple as that. And yeah, it's got bigger and bigger.
A lot bigger. This year, for the first time, Yahoo, YouTube, AOL, and Hulu were there touting original online shows.
All who respect our authority over electrical power enjoy the benefits.
That's a clip from Electric City, an animated series written and directed by Tom Hanks for Yahoo. Yahoo is also debuting a weekly health and wellness show starring Katie Couric. Erin McPherson heads original programming for Yahoo. At one digital upfronts event, she sounded an awful lot like a TV executive.
One of our strategic programming pillars is blockbusters. And I think that's because our platform, reaching 700 million unique users, is positioned to do the Michael Bay of the internet.
That would be Michael Bay, who directed Transformers. And if Yahoo is going all Michael Bay mass market, rival YouTube is going in the opposite direction. The Google-owned video site is spending $100 million to develop 100 channels that appeal to highly targeted audiences. There's a Madonna dance channel, a Wall Street Journal channel, and even a channel where astronomy enthusiasts can get the intergalactic lowdown.
M24 is the Sagittarius star cloud, and it's actually one of the biggest items in the Messier catalog.
AOL, Netflix, and Hulu are also launching shows this year. Bill Ward is a social media professor at Syracuse University. He says it's clear why internet companies are getting into show business.
They're realizing if they're just the pipeline, they can be seen more as a commodity, where if they're actually creating original content, you can sell advertising around the content.
Online video advertising is expected to reach $3 billion this year and $9 billion by 2016. Advertisers are excited because they can do things online that they can't on TV. When it comes to internet programming, the lines between content and advertising get pretty blurry. Case in point, the hit online show Mom Life.
Do you know how much calcium your child is supposed to be getting?
Sitting alongside that episode on Healthy Bones, an ad for True Moo chocolate milk. The Mom Life has reached 100 million viewers and tackles issues about child rearing, health, and beauty. Advertisers include Johnson & Johnson and Kraft, Host Jennifer Pate says sponsors are very involved in the content.
We create content that we're passionate about that aligns with their messaging. We really work directly with the brands. We look at them as partners.
Welcome to the brave new world of branded content. Syracuse University's Bill Ward says all of media is moving towards this seamless experience where ads and content not only flow together, but become almost indistinguishable.
You're watching a video and you like the sweater that somebody's wearing and you roll your mouse over that, and then it tells you without interrupting the video what brand sweater that is, how much it is, and with a click, then you can purchase that sweater. You know, that's a pretty engaging experience.
And potentially a profitable one if you made the sweater or the show. An estimated 145 million people are watching online videos and the ads that come with them. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Time now for a little Freakonomics Radio. It's that moment every couple of weeks where we talk to Stephen Dubner, the co-author of the books and the blogs of the same name. It is the hidden side of everything. Dubner, as always, it's good to talk to you.
Great to be here, Kai. Hey, yeah. You know, it seems like you talk about your mom on the show quite a bit. Am I right?
I don't know. Maybe.
And it sounds from what I hear that you two have a fairly loving relationship. I'm also right on that.
Number one, she's listening, so watch yourself. And number two, yeah, you know, we get along, me and mom.
I'm just thinking with Mother's Day coming up, you know, two Sundays from now, yes. I'm guessing you're thinking about maybe sending your mom some flowers, yes?
Okay, two things. One is that it's all I can do to remember to get my wife flowers on Mother's Day, let alone my own mother. And two, the dirty secret, which I will deny if you repeat it, my wife actually does the flowers for my mother.
Ah, but mom does get
them. But she gets something, yeah. Yeah.
She gets them. So yeah. She is not alone. No. In the U.S., every year, we spend about $12 billion on cut flowers alone.
Wow.
Mother's Day is obviously a huge part of that. But here's something you may not know, Kai. About 80% of these cut flowers are imported, mostly from equatorial countries that get, you know, 12 hours of year-round sunlight. Mario Valle is a flower wholesaler in Los Angeles. He handles about 2 million flowers a year. And here's how they get to him.
Anything that's coming out of South America is generally air freighted into Miami, then it's trucked over to California.
Really? They fly to Miami and then drive it to here?
And I do not want to rain on your mother's parade or anybody's mother's parade, but yes. There is something going on here, okay? We live in this day and age where people are obsessed with food miles and the carbon footprint
of
everything
that
we consume. So if that's the way we're going to be, here's what I want to know. Where is the outrage over these globe-trotting Mother's Day flowers, okay? I mean, if you ship food across the planet, at least we eat it. It's our sustenance, right? But with flowers, you just look at them for a couple of days and then, you know— into the trash.
So this is you up on your high horse here. You are now killing all the joy and glory that is Mother's Day and cut flowers in this country?
Kai, it is not my nature to scold. I'd hope you know that by now. But I do find it curious that cut flowers have somehow escaped the environmental scrutiny that accompanies what we eat, how we transport ourselves. You know, it may be a halo effect from the flowers themselves. I mean, how do you hate on roses and tulips? They're so pretty, right?
Yeah. So here's the thing, though. Let me rephrase that. If my wife doesn't send my mother flowers for Mother's Day, then I'm in deep and serious trouble.
I don't want that to happen.
Yeah.
Okay. That's the last thing I want to happen. So let's look to a different holiday for a potential solution.
Okay.
Christmas. Every year, we buy about 35 million Christmas trees in this country, about $2 billion worth. Now, again, we're talking crops that are harvested and transported solely for our viewing, but not our eating pleasure. But every year, the share of artificial Christmas trees grows, and now we're up to about 40% fake Christmas trees, meaning there's no need to grow and transport another tree next year, you know, the year after.
Stop, because I'm not doing a fake Christmas tree. I'm just not going to do it.
Let me try to persuade you of a little something.
Right.
Kai, you have a package there in the studio. We sent you something by air freight.
It's
right a good time to open that up.
Okay. Number one, I'm a little disappointed because it's clearly not beer. but all right, that's fine. Is this a corsage or something equally sensitive?
What do you think? How do they look?
They look lovely. They're yellow roses.
And what are they made of?
Yeah, they're not real.
they're plastic flowers. Yeah. And they're beautiful, right? They do wonderful things yes. with plastic these days. So here's the thing. We may associate flowers with nature and yes. plastic with the yes. opposite, but that is, in fact, a very simplistic view of how the world actually works. So here's Suzanne Friedberg. She's a Dartmouth professor and author who's been studying how carbon footprints are calculated. Here's what she thinks of the idea of giving plastic flowers instead of real ones.
Because they're so lightweight, they wouldn't need to be flown anywhere. They wouldn't decompose and produce greenhouse gases in any landfill. There's the endless lifespan, so the possibilities for regifting them.
So, Kai, listen, yeah. if you really love your mother, and I'm not implying that you don't, by the yeah. way, I want you to think about sending her, having your wife send her, some plastic flowers this year. Because if you want, you can even regift this bouquet I sent you, because like Professor Friedberg suggests, you know, so because I understand you're a bit of a cheapskate as well.
Hey, man. I am, actually. How did you know? Stephen Dubner, Freakonomics.com is the website. He'll be back in a couple of weeks. We'll see you, man.
Hey, thanks, Kai.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Novo Nordisk, combining drug discovery with technology to turn science into diabetes treatments. Learn more at NovoNordisk-US.com. Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out, a ray of baseball sunshine here in rainy Los Angeles today. The sale of the Los Angeles Dodgers closed last night, a team that includes, as I'm sure you've heard, Magic Johnson, paid now former owner Frank McCourt $2-plus billion for the club. McCourt does still have a stake in the parking lots surrounding Dodger Stadium, but at a press conference today, the new owners took a big first step at making amends for what was generally regarded as a disastrous tenure by the much-disliked McCourt. Parking at the stadium is going to be cheaper, $10 instead of $15. So they make fans happy and, at the same time, take some money out of Frank McCourt's pocket. Pretty nifty, huh? All right, that's it. We got to go. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow lost 10 points, less than a tenth of 1%. The NASDAQ up 9 points, 3/10%. The S&P 500 down 3 points, 0.25% there. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineer the program for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.